Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforawakening.com, which is the homepage, and listen to the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. That's in the Black Belt. I'm sorry, and catch the live stream from that location also, or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media is there also. Full of new podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, and always interesting articles that you can download, read, share with your friends. Again, make that one of your favorites and put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we rescheduled our guest from last week, Miss Amani Sawari, to talk about the prison strike and her assessments and the perspectives on what has happened with our brothers and sisters behind enemy lines, as Scotty Reed says it. And hopefully she'll join us this evening. She's scheduled to join us in the first hour. Afterwards, we'll just transition into open forum. It's a few things out there that we can talk about, and a few announcements that we'll have to make. But we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215 215- 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Archer Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother.
Yes, sir.
How are you, sir?
No, I'm doing fine. I'm looking forward to this update. The sister will give us, Sister Sawari will give us about the prison striker. I'd just like to, become more informed about that. But this weekend was pretty eventful.
Yeah, it's a lot of things going on. I guess maybe in before the program ends and maybe the second hour, we'll touch on some of these things. And plus, I had a couple of announcements that I want to share with the listening audience. But I think we have Ms. Sawari on the line. Ms. Sawari, are you with us?
I'm here. I don't know if you can hear me.
I can hear you. How are you?
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's no problem.
Honor is ours.
We were looking for you last week because that was the end of the prison strike, but I knew that you were busy. Because
I was at an event that I didn't know it would go on as long as it did.
It's no problem. I'm glad that you're here this week. Ms. Sawari, that the prison strike was slated from August 21st to September 9th, from what I understand, yes. Because we have a program on Black Talk Radio Network that deals directly with our folk, brothers and sisters that are incarcerated. That says that some of the prisoners haven't stopped They're continuing. Exactly. But I want you to kind of give us a little background on what has went on, some of the accomplishments or things that some of the prisoners feel as though they made headway on, and talk about some of the things, your assessments and perspectives of what's going on with our brothers and sisters that are incarcerated. But before we do that, Mr. Wari, talk about yourself some. I mean, you're involved in activism. How did you get involved with helping our brothers and sisters that are locked up?
Well, I am currently living in Seattle, Washington, and I came to Seattle to go to the University of Washington. And after my graduating there in 2016, I'd started SawariMe.org, and that is where JLS found me writing about just prisoners' rights and defending prisoners' rights and the fact that we should be protecting prisoners' lives on the inside. And they recruited me to write their monthly newsletter leading up to the Millions for Prisoners March last year.
Okay.
So that is how a lot of prisoners came to know who I was, through my writing of that newsletter, and putting articles together for them and taking in their artwork and their poetry and just putting that into a newsletter and creating community around the Millions for Prisoners March. And then this year, they asked me to participate again in a much larger capacity as their spokesperson for the strike, as well as using my website to be the home and the place where endorsements would live, as well as writing the newsletter again. So this year's newsletter is Solid Black Fist. And so putting that together with JLS's suggestions on what should go in it, they would send me the articles and I just put them together in a newsletter and post a map of where the strike is hitting and what states we're in. So it was definitely really exciting to just grow and be in that capacity this year. And I've really enjoyed just working with prisoners and working on their behalf.
If I may add just
ahead,
to
Richard.
That, did you realize was being a part of the support system and communication network between those are in prison and those of us who are in another type of prison? Did you expect that you would be a part of that experience, or would that would be a part of your experience as you were coming out of University of Washington, is what you said?
I definitely did not expect that. When I was, I didn't know what I was going to be doing with my degree. When I picked my degree, so I had two majors. I studied communications and law and economics. And so it was, I didn't know what I wanted to do with that. I just knew that's what I liked. And so then to be stepping into this role that prisoners sort of called me into with the skills and expertise that I had, I realized, wow, that is why I picked those majors. I didn't know it at the time, but my creator did. And so everything just kind of fell into place. Once I stepped into this role and started working on prisoners' behalf, I definitely have a heart for our incarcerated communities and the people who are living in these conditions. And I definitely think that they should have the lead and should be taking the lead in the reforms that we need to see in our criminal justice system. So that's why I'm so passionate about this work. And no, I wasn't expecting it, but I'm really glad that it turned out this way.
And we are too.
Mr. Wari, talk about the some of the list of demands that that our brothers and sisters wanted to be put forth, or at least let everybody know the demands that that they wanted. And before you do that, because you mentioned about the certain states, was it in every state in this continental United States, or was it in certain states where it was focused, or how did that transpire?
So things started off in South Carolina with the massacre that happened April 15th with the 7 prisoners that lost their lives. The JLS that is in the Lee County institution where that event happened,
okay,
are the ones who crafted the demands and put the call out for the strike. And so it started there. And then before the strike started, there were at least 17 states that signed on to participate in the strike. And now, as the strike ended, we've had at least 17 states participate, in addition to 3 regions overseas who've also expressed solidarity and participating with the strike. So it's definitely been successful in organizing prisoners across state lines as well as overseas, in addition to also kind of changing the narrative around prisoners striking, that prisoners have the right to strike. They have the right to stand up and say, you know, these living in these working conditions aren't beneficial for us. They're destructive. And so prisoners are using their voice to amplify these demands and to raise awareness about what changes they want to see in the criminal justice system. And on the outside, it's definitely changed our perspective on how we view prisoners in the role of making these reforms. We now know prisoners are the most intimately connected to these systems, and therefore they have the most knowledge on what changes need to happen in order for the system to improve. And they can lead us in making a dramatic transformation in our criminal justice system. And these 10 demands are beautiful in that we can see that these are transformative changes. It's not just a simple policy reform. It's a transformative change in the way that our system works, so that it can work for people to improve their lives instead of being destructive as it has been for decades now.
Mr. Warren, can you go over a few, those 10 demands?
Yeah, for sure. I can definitely go through them. So the first demand, immediate improvement to the conditions of prison and prison policies that recognize the humanity of imprisoned men and women. Number two, an immediate end to prison slavery. All persons imprisoned in any place of detention under the United States jurisdiction must be paid the prevailing wage in their state or territory for their labor. Three, the Prison Litigation Reform Act must be rescinded, allowing imprisoned humans a proper channel to address grievances and violations of their rights. Four, the Truth in Sentencing Act and Sentencing Reform Act must be rescinded so that imprisoned humans have a possibility of rehabilitation and parole. No human shall be sentenced to death by incarceration or serve any sentence without the possibility of parole. Five, an immediate end to racial overcharging, over-sentencing, and parole denials of Black and brown humans. Black humans shall no longer be denied parole because the victim of the crime was white, which is a particular problem in southern states. Six, an immediate end to racist gang enhancement laws targeting Black and brown humans. Seven, no imprisoned human shall be denied access to rehabilitation programs at their place of detention because of their label as a violent offender. Eight, state prisons must be funded specifically to offer more rehabilitation services. Nine, Pell Grants must be reinstated in all U.S. states and territories. 10, the voting rights of all confined citizens serving prison sentences, pretrial detainees, and so-called ex-felons must be counted. Representation is demanded. All voices count.
Mr. Warren, a couple of those I want to go back to. The immediate end of prison slavery.
Yes.
You know, a lot of our people don't realize that slavery never ended. It just change forms. It was an exception clause in the 13th
right.
Amendment for slavery. And I think you highlighted in the, either a publication that you co-authored, or it was a clip that I saw it, where you listed some of the companies that benefit from this slavery of our people behind bars. Talk about some of these companies and how they're benefiting and making huge profits with modern day slavery still going on.
Oh yeah. So a lot of people, like you said, think that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. Well, there's no way that something can be abolished if there's an exception clause, like you mentioned. We can't say, you know, this is done except this. So we saw how a lot of people were kind of moved from this slave status to this prison class status and operate as slaves. People like to call it indentured servitude, but it's not. It's literally called slavery in our Constitution. Our Constitution gave slavery a place in this country by writing it into the 13th Amendment and giving it legal grounds for use as punishment. And some of the companies that use slavery are the big ones, the ones that we see every day as we're in our shopping malls, driving down the street. Fast food companies like Wendy's, they use prison slave labor to make their uniforms, as well as their utensils and their containers for their products. Companies like Walmart, they have super low prices and they've got everything there, but there's a reason why they can afford these sorts of accommodations. They can afford to have these big buildings on every single corner. Walmart uses prison labor to demanufacture their products. So they get a whole bunch of products that come in, and then they drop those products off at the penitentiary, and then the workers there, the prisoners there, will scrub off whatever identification sort of labels are on them from other stores so that they can put Walmart's labels onto those products and then send them back to Walmart. So prisoners are doing the labor that is required for these companies to put these products on their shelves, to offer super low prices, because they have a huge labor force that they're paying little to nothing, that they're paying pennies for hours and hours of work. And so when we look at these companies and we can see, okay, companies like Shell Gas Station use prisoners for their oil spill cleanups. They have these labor forces that they can exploit and manipulate. A lot of these companies are the same ones that are making these very negative environmental decisions. McDonald's mass producing beef and things like this. We can see that when these companies are willing to exploit human labor, they're willing to exploit our environment, they're willing to exploit other resources in our country. And so we have to draw the line and say, you know, I'm not going to allow the exploitation of humans, the exploitation of the environment, and the exploitation of other resources. And I'm not going to vote and allow this with the purchases that I make. We really need to be intentional about where we're spending our money, because that vote, arguably, in my opinion, is the most important vote that we have in this country. When we choose to get a McDouble, we're voting, okay, exploitation of humans is okay, exploitation of the environment is fine, we can mass produce and mass kill cows, that's okay with me. And, you know, I haven't been to McDonald's in years. I just choose that I don't want to make that sacrifice. I want to stand up and boycott this company and boycott any other company that chooses to exploit prisoners' labor and fuel this prison industrial slave complex. So we have to make those choices, not just in going out to a march or retweeting something online, but also in how we are making those daily decisions and what we're buying.
If I may, and Sister Suari, add on to that or get clarity on that, because we recognize there's two types of prison systems. There's the private prison systems and the public prison system, right? So are we saying when companies do hire men and women to do this type of labor work, are they paying, say, and I'm looking at the public prison, are they paying these state prisoners, state prisons, or the state, the local state government to be able to utilize this labor?
They are paying, so the companies that come in as like a third party company are paying the prisons to be able to use the labor. And they are not paying the prisoners for the labor that prisoners are sacrificing, the hours that they're putting in for those companies. So it's sort of, and then we, the taxpayers, are paying for the prisoners' food, their stay. Right. We're subsidizing the cost of those companies to be able to come in and make billions of dollars off of the prisoners' labor. So it's sort of like the company is kind of going over the head of the people and creating sweatshops in our country. We always are upset about the sweatshops overseas that make products like, you know, our phones and our shoes and things like that. But we've got sweatshops all over the place in our country. So we need to also be critical about that as well.
And the reason why I wanted to keep developing that, if you don't mind, because the prison, as you said, the public is paying, subsidizing that, but also the legislators, the state legislators, because prisons are funded by the state. State legislators are aware, and I got the impression, either the companies are paying the prisons directly, individually, like the prison warden, or they are getting an okay from the state legislators to pay the prison directly, which, as you said, and that's the point that I wanted us to drive home on this, that we, the public, vote for the legislators, and they are using our tax money to enslave and to create these sweatshops. So we're not only paying
in the store when we buy the product, voting mm-hmm. there. We're also voting for the people who are maintaining getting the money from these private companies also by allowing the government to be able to have that kind of arrangement with the company. Does that make sense?
Yes, and that's a very, very valid and very important point that people sort of overlook, that we are kind of burning the stick at both ends with that.
You know, a couple of other things I want to hit on in the 10 demands. You know, you mentioned about our brothers and sisters being abused in prisons and working for pennies, basically. I'm on the show. I saw a report that during the fires in California, that they were using prison labor, and a couple of men lost their lives. Now, firefighters that go out there, they're highly trained, and they're well paid. So you're sending prisoners. I'm quite sure they weren't trained to be firefighters. You're sending prisoners into a dangerous situation to fight fires, and a few men had lost their lives. Were you aware of that report, Sister Imani?
Yes, yes. And in addition to not being well-trained and being very, very, very vastly underpaid for the work that they're doing, $2 a day for going out and risking their lives to fight these fires, they're also ill-equipped. They're not given the same amount of equipment that a professional firefighter would be given when they go even to fight a fire in a home. These guys are going out and fighting fires in woods and places that are much more dangerous terrains, and they're not given the same amount of equipment. So it's just another tragic way that this system persists in our country. And we've been able to sort of overlook it and excuse it. But the strike has been able to shine a light on this. And we need to really, really be focused on continuing to look into what's happening in our prisons. A huge reason why this continues to happen and these abuses continue to happen is because we're not looking, we're not paying attention. Our prisons are put off far away from us. The walls are super high around them, and we're not given the opportunity to look in and see what's going on a regular basis. And we need to really be intentional about looking in and saying, I want to know what's going on in my prisons. I want to know what I'm paying for. I want to know the condition of the people that are in there.
You know, number 7 and number 9 of the list of demands, and I want to go back over. Number 7 mm-hmm. says, no imprisoned human shall be denied access to rehabilitation programs at their place of detention. And number 9 says, Pell Grants must be reinstated in all U.S. prisons, all U.S. states and territories. When you talk about humans being denied access to rehabilitation and Pell Grants, you're talking about making a man or woman that's behind bars now capable of turning their life around once they come out. When you deny these things, you intentionally want to create recidivism or create a situation where these men and women, once they get out, they're almost forced to come back.
Right.
Or you kind of lessen their chances to even make a successful life outside of those walls. I mean, it's all geared to have our people constantly going back and forth into slavery.
Right.
Can I raise another question point? Did you mention the jailhouse lawyers speak their input in the prison strike? Can you help us understand who are they and what do they do and how have they influenced the strike?
Yeah, jailhouse lawyers speak are the incarcerated organizers of the strike. They're the ones who developed the demands and put out a call for a national prison strike. They recruited me into being an outside organizer, as well as the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee and other groups around the country to spread these demands and raise awareness on their behalf. So Jailhouse Lawyers Speak is the organizing force behind all of this, and they are the ones that provide us with the details on what they want to happen, the actions, how they want to move forward. They just recently posted a petition. It's got over 16,000 signatures now, demanding that Congress take a look at these demands and respond. So they are the organizing force behind it all.
Let me go and grab a call. Let's go to 803. 803, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Peace, Max Parthas. What's happening, man?
Hey, I'm glad to have you with us, brother.
Well, you guys are covering all the base. You ain't leaving me nothing to ask, really. So I just want to start by thanking the sister for her dedication and all the work that you have put into making this thing happen, for starters. So you are greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
The other thing, there is one thing that I want to ask, and I've been having this conversation with a lot of people lately. It's about crimes against humanity. And many aspects of the prison industrial complex, or modern day slavery as we call it, has systematic crimes against humanity. For instance, the torture that people endure. And some of the organizers, like Brother Kinetic Justice, for instance, have been suffering that torture now for months on end. And when we discuss these crimes against humanity, people tend to separate them. They'll look at it like, okay, the government runs all of this, but only that part is a crime against humanity. And that tends to lend some confusion. What do you think about that?
For me?
Yeah. Yes, Ms. Warren.
Okay. I think that a lot of people tend to dismiss what happens to people that are incarcerated because they've committed a crime against society, so they deserve whatever happens to them, which is really a tragic way of thinking, for us to assign labels to people and say, because of this label, you deserve to be treated this way. Label, whether it's a criminal, a convict, a homosexual, an elderly person, whatever that may be, we can't allow labels to separate us from being able to see the humanity and the potential in a person. There's a lot that's lost when we decide to put a person away because of a label. So when we say, okay, they committed a crime against society, so they deserve whatever happens, does a person really deserve to be in a cave 23 hours a day? Right now, brothers that are on lockdown, brothers and sisters on lockdown, they're spending their entire days in a cell. Do they also deserve to be served inedible food, to not have access to treatment, to not have access to adequate medical care, to bleed out if something happens, a violent incident occurs? 15 people died in Mississippi's prison. Do they also deserve to die while they're in there just because they're not given the attention that they're needed? The circumstances are so deadly. All these things stacked up on top of each other, we realize, okay, this is bigger than what it's supposed to be. This is more dangerous than what we assessed it was supposed to be. So we realize that incarceration in itself is a crime, yes, against humanity. And we are sort of assigning this weight on a group of people, a prisoner class, and they can't carry it. So I definitely think, yes, it's a crime against humanity, and we can't repay a crime against society with a crime against humanity. Like we mentioned earlier, it's burning the stick at both ends, and it's eventually just going to destroy itself because it's not productive. It's not developing anyone. We need a system that caters to every individual, and we know that behavior is due to what has happened in somebody's past. We need to address those things. There are rehab courts, there are drug treatment courts, there are different types of ways that we can assign care to people that addresses their individual concerns and helps them develop to the best of their potential. And right now, the one size fits all, just throw away the key and put them in jail, isn't working. It's actually taxing and it's costing us more than what it would if we just really looked at every individual person and gave them what they needed to develop the best of their ability. Does that answer your question or address it?
Max, you still with us? Max? I think we might have lost Max. Well, I guess that did address it. Max, thank you for being...
Sorry about that.
No, go ahead.
I was muted while I was listening. I'm sorry, you did answer that very well. And if it's okay, gentlemen, can I ask one more question?
Certainly, Max.
This was not covered in any of the issues during the prison strike, but it is a thing that is very important, and that's human trafficking. Where many of these prisons from one state are shipping prisoners to other states, and they often do that with organizers within the prisons. For instance, in Vermont, they have prisoners in Michigan that they're about to send to Mississippi into a private prison, and that is, by all accounts, human trafficking. Do you intend on addressing that at any point in the future?
I definitely think that demand number one, while it doesn't directly talk about human trafficking, it definitely covers, like, for me, everything that could fall within dehumanizing people. So when we decide, okay, we're just going to ship someone across the state because we don't have any room for them here, that's something that is dehumanizing. We wouldn't do that to people had we not assigned them this label of incarcerated, a criminal. So now we say, okay, well, it doesn't matter if they're super far away from their family and everything that they know. They're already in an unstable environment, but we're just going to ship them across the country because it costs less or whatever the case may be. So I definitely think it falls loosely, at least, into demand number one, immediate improvement to the conditions of all prisons and prison policies. And it should be a prison policy that we don't ship people across the country, because it's definitely not adding to their well-being when someone is incarcerated and now their family bonds are being weakened because they can't get regular visits and they don't have access to the people that are in their village that would help them with growing and developing while they're incarcerated.
Thank you for your answer. And again, I appreciate all your work. Thank you, gentlemen. Allow me to participate in the conversation.
Hey, Max, when can you be heard?
You can check out at New Abolitionist Radio right here on blacktalkradionetwork.com. Every Wednesday at 8 p.m. we go live. And I would like to offer an open invitation to the sister to come on anytime you'd like. Maybe we can contact you later and set up an interview.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Max, thank you for your call.
Thank you, brother.
And can I
go ahead, Richard.
Raise another one of the list of concerns that goes to, I guess, going to be my theme, which is the what I'm hoping that the jailhouse lawyer speaks want us to do as far as those who are in prison on outside of the prison, as far as to help in developing the policy to assist those demands. And I heard about the petition. And that is the one about the Prison Litigation Reform Act. Now, could you explain what that Litigation Reform Act is? And is that, when we say it's a litigation reform, is that something within the some legislative body at this point, or have been and wants to be repealed or wants to be developed? What is it, and how do we look at it and to be able to support it one way or another?
So the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act barred prisoners from being able to participate in the judicial process and having their rights protected. So when a prisoner's civil rights or human rights are violated, whether they're abused physically or sexually, abused in any way, they have to file that abuse within the prison. And they are subject to only an internal investigation. So a lot of the time, who violated them is also going to be playing a role in that investigation, or at least in cahoots with the person who is investigating what's going on. And I've, for example, in Michigan, there was a prisoner who, once he was sent to the hole, all of his belongings were taken away. And when they were returned to him, a lot of his documents, like obituaries of family members and loved ones that have passed on, and articles that he had written, were gone. They were stolen or lost or whatever the case may be. And these were things that he was not able to replace. And so he filed a grievance because he wasn't able to sue or go to the courts to have them recovered. And once that grievance was filed and 10 days passed, he was supposed to receive a response. And when they returned his call, they said that his grievance was never filed. So whoever was responsible for filing that grievance failed to do so. And now the time limitation on having that response, he can't file another grievance. It's been over 10 days. And these types of things happen all the time. Prisoners are dependent on the people who a lot of the times are responsible for their abuse to help them in recovery or healing or finding a solution. And a lot of the times they can't trust those sources. So prisoners are completely barred from being able to participate in having their rights protected on a judicial level.
Is this at the state level or at the federal level?
This is at the federal level. So in no state can a prisoner, they have to exhaust all of the internal grievance procedures. And a lot of the times they can't get to the point of exhausting those procedures because paperwork was lost or a step wasn't filed in the right time or too many days have passed. So a lot of the times they can't make it to the point of having a court case brought on their behalf. And then even if there is a lawyer who gets them through the point of exhausting the internal investigation, they're not allowed to be paid over a certain amount for helping the prisoner. So it really deters lawyers from working with people who are incarcerated and helping them protect their human rights because they can't be compensated for that work. So this is, prisoners are asking that this law be rescinded so that they can have their human rights protected and participate in judicial proceedings. And the people who are responsible for their abuses can be correctly punished and can suffer from consequences justly.
So this is something, in the present political cycle, they're talking about 2018, the midterm elections. This is something that those people who are running for Congress, those of us who are going to the ballot box to vote, should be asking those congresspersons, do they support repealing this Prison Litigation Reform Act? Would that be a fair way to present it?
Exactly, yes.
Mr. Warr, you brought up in the conversation that you had with our first caller about the 15 prisoners that had been mysteriously died in Mississippi. And that kind of leads into my next question for you. And I'm gonna set it up by reading a paragraph or two from this Guardian article that was in the Guardian August 31st. It says, U.S. inmates claim retaliation by prison officials as a result of multi-state strike. Prisoners and their families say the strike leaders are picked off one by one and sent to solitary confinement or suddenly transferred. As the multi-state strike continues through the second week, many participants have been hit by prison officials with swift and vicious reprisals, advocates, prisoners, and their families says. It is claimed that inmates, especially those seen as organizers, have been subject to solitary confinement or revoking of communication privileges and long-distance transfers in an attempt to weaken the effects of work stoppages and to chill dissent. Talk about this in relation to what you mentioned about the 15 people that mysteriously died in Mississippi.
Yeah, so in Mississippi, 15 people passed away, 15 people who were incarcerated and under state care. The state still has yet to release what happened, the results of an autopsy, and we don't know for sure if these people were connected to the strike, if they were striking. We know that a lot of strikers who have confirmed to be participating in the strike have been moved to solitary confinement, have had their outside communications cut off. For example, David Easley, who's hunger striking in Toledo, Ohio, in Toledo's Correctional Institution, he was moved into solitary confinement and isn't allowed to receive mail, to send mail. Comrade Malik, same conditions. Jason Renard Walker, who wrote publications raising awareness about the conditions in Texas prisons, was moved into solitary confinement, not allowed any clean clothes, not allowed to take showers, not given toilet paper or towels. So they're intentionally moving people who have said, I'm participating in the national prison strike, moving them into solitary confinement and cutting them off from the general population, trying to inhibit their ability to raise awareness about the strike, and then also trying to cut them off from outside organizers and being able to communicate with organizers. Now, these brothers and sisters have a way of making sure that they can still get their communications out, but the conditions in prisons definitely are so harsh and so aggressive that when they find that someone has decided to stand up against it, they're completely trying to take them out of the picture so that this spirit doesn't continue to get ignited and the flame doesn't continue to be fanned. But we already know that it's absolutely impossible to cut off that spirit we saw with the assassination of George Jackson that continued to fuel people leading into the Attica uprising and even into today as we continue to celebrate 45 years later and recognize those dates and remember what they started and continued for us in the era of prisoner resistance. So the conditions that happened in Mississippi, what led to what happened in Mississippi, we don't know if it's directly connected to the strike, but we do know that it is indirectly connected in the fact that conditions caused 15 prisoners to die, and these are the conditions that we are demanding be resolved in our demand number one in the national prison strike. These are the ones that we are trying to raise awareness about, that we are trying to get officials to be accountable for. We want them to be able to serve our communities that are incarcerated and not contribute to the destruction of those communities. We want them to be passionate about service, about corrections, about rehabilitation. They're the Department of Corrections, so they should be serving and correcting and helping people in their lives, and that's not what they're doing right now. And for the state to be so aggressive in shutting down people who are trying to bring better conditions into their community, it really says something about the state's agenda and what's important to the state. And it's not to bring humanity into these spaces or to bring hope into these spaces or education or rehabilitation. They're actually acting against those things. So we need to call that out and demand that a dramatic transformation take place.
You know, I agree with you with what you said totally about prisons being moved to areas away from where loved ones can access them, high walls where you can't see what's going on. Because if it's not for activists like you and shows like Max Parthas and Scotty Reed does, it a lot of our people don't know that activists that were active during the Black Power movement and men like Mumia Abu-Jamal and others are in prison and in solitary confinement. And some of these men and women have been in solitary for a number of years. Now, if that's not inhuman, if that's not dehumanizing and inhuman treatment, I don't know what is. Somebody can lose their mind after being in solitary confinement for a month, let alone years of solitary. That's incredible that type of stuff goes on.
And the only way that it can continue to go on is if we refuse to take a look.
Okay.
And that's a lot of people aren't looking and seeing that that's what's happening. If more people, if the masses of people knew what went on in prisons and in Lee County, it finally sort of happened, that pictures came out of the bloodshed and the gore and the terrible conditions that prisoners are forced to live in. And then people said, wow, this is why prisoners are acting out and calling out and demanding that they just have the right to live. They're asking for a right to live and to be able to support themselves and to be able to feel safe and protected. And we should give them that. They are citizens of this country and deserve to have the right to live and to feel safe. And so we definitely need to be looking in and holding officers and officials accountable for what's going on in there. Because it's the officials that are responsible for the violent environment. They have the power to create an environment that is productive, that is full of hope, that is rehabilitative. And they're not doing that. They're feeding on other things to create a violent and unstable environment. And that's not what should be happening.
Mr. Wari, before you we start winding this portion down, let me read a portion that you stated in a published report. When was this? A couple of weeks ago. And you were talking about toxic conditions in our prisons. It says, Amani Sawari, a media representative for the protests, told Earther, prisons are often located next to places that are waste sites or dump sites. Polluted areas, polluted water causes health complications and other environmental problems. Earlier this year, Donald Trump set aside $510 million to build a new federal prison on top of an abandoned coal mine in Kentucky. It is the most ever spent to construct a federal prison in United States history. Talk about that, because you mentioned about a lot of these prisons being located near dump sites and where the war. Go ahead.
Yes. So that also ties into the inhumane conditions that we are trying to put an end to through the national prison strike. And when we say that there is a community of people that we've placed this label on that allows us to be okay with them being dehumanized, then that happens at all levels. Dehumanization doesn't just stop at them wearing the uniform and being locked up. It doesn't stop there. Dehumanization happens in the food, in the water, in the lack of classes, the lack of rehabilitation, in the areas that they're put in. And they're placed next to these dump sites and next to these areas that are unfit for places for humans to be, that they're uninhabitable for humans to be. Because we've said, okay, this we can put that there because we don't care about that group of people. We wouldn't build a school there. We wouldn't build a university there or a park there. So why would we put a place where people who are going to be confined for years to be forced to live there and to drink the water there and be affected by the soil that's contaminated in that area? And that's what happens. We've assigned these people with a label that we've allowed to be dehumanized, and dehumanization happens at every single facet when we allow it to just go into one area. So we need to say, you know, we're done with dehumanization. We're not going to, and why would we pour hundreds of thousands of dollars into something that's going to end up being destructive? That's completely illogical for us to pour so much of taxpayers' dollars into building a facility that's going to be on top of a place that's unstable, and then to be putting people there and into an environment that's going to be violent and unhealthy, and then to be continuing to fund that area and they're living there and the food that they're going to be served and the water that's going to be contaminated. It's all completely illogical. And that's what happens when we allow dehumanization to exist for any group of people. It persists in every area of people activity in that area.
You know, Elliot and Sister Sawari, this reminds me of Elliot. When we interviewed about the Sugarland, the city of Sugarland,
yes,
and the prison that was built there, the condition that was created, the importance of history for us to understand as we assist in dealing with the, you know, assisting in the prisoners' demands. On the outside, using our political thrust, I hope everyone is getting the message that they're asking us to participate by whether contacting the representatives or checking in with your legislators or signing the petitions or listening to this powerful young lady as the spokesperson for them. And I'm glad that they did select you. I'm just sitting here smiling because it shows that even without the kind of educational thing, the education that's going on, the organization that's going on in the prisons, and as we look at George Jackson and, you know, that period, that the prison organizing has been phenomenal, and we should match it on the outside like it's being done on the inside.
Yes, definitely. And organizing on behalf of prisoners on the outside has been just vastly vamped up this year. We saw participation of solidarity events on kickoff day in at least 21 cities across the country when August 21st rolled around. So people are definitely stepping up to the plate and saying, you know, if prisoners are risking their lives, prisoners lost their jobs, they lost their status as prisoners, moved up to different levels of status. They've lost their ability to earn income, access to their families. They've been transferred across state borders, all to strike. Then we, at least on the outside, can choose alternatives for how we spend our money and demand that our legislatures respond to prisoners' demands and sign petitions and hold up signs and go to noise demos. That's what we could do at the very least to just attempt to match the massive amount of bravery and strength that they have demonstrated to us through this strike.
Ms. Sawari, two questions before we leave you this evening or we move on. And they have I guess one of it is of a personal nature. Do you find it easy to organize? And my focus is always our people, and especially our young people. I'm talking about black and brown. Do you find it easy to organize young brothers and sisters once they become aware of certain issues that are going on out here? Because you're out here and you're in different states and you're talking to young people, people your age, brothers and sisters your age. Do you find it easier to organize them once they become aware of these issues going on?
One thing that really made me excited being in Seattle this year was that when I talked to people about what was going on, with the level of passion that I feel for what prisoners are doing, they were excited to step up to the plate and see what could they do. And every single person has some sort of talent or expertise or skill that can be used to serve in this movement. And people get nervous when you ask them to organize because they think, okay, I can't do everything. I'm not Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. I can't do that. But organizing doesn't have to be that big. It can just be you deciding to transcribe a letter that's going to be used in a press release. It can be that simple. And then that letter goes out to hundreds and thousands of people because you took 10 minutes out of your day to transcribe it. So it's little tasks, and when you decide to step up to the plate, then I have no problem delegating tasks to you based on the talent that you have. And then as you begin to see that materialize into something that's bigger than you, then that excitement just grows. So just in the way that I'm able to speak to someone and sort of bring it down to their level and show them that their talent is so much bigger than what they think it is, when they just use a few minutes of their day, then they definitely step up to the plate because they know how big of a problem that this is and how complex it is. And it demands a piece of all of us.
And Ms. Wari, how do your parents feel about your activism?
My parents are funny. I have a very religious, beautiful Black mother. And she's super supportive,
okay.
Super amazing. My dad is also supportive. He's more of an economic and logical person, a big Black man. And he's more of, I need you to stay safe.
Okay.
Don't be going out there doing crazy stuff. And I'm just like, you know what? Safety is not my priority, but I know I'll stay safe for as long as I'm supposed to be here doing this work. So... That okay. They're both supportive in their own way, but they definitely want me to stay safe out here. So.
Okay. You know, you're the second activist that we've talked to in that Seattle area. Boy, his name just flew out of my head, Richard, the brother that organized the Africatown.
Africatown, yeah. I don't have his name in my head.
Yeah. Are you aware of that project going on, Sister Amani?
Yes, I definitely heard of Africatown, and I've been at some beautiful Black arts events,
okay.
and definitely cross paths with the people working on that. And yeah, it's amazing. There's not a lot of us out here in Seattle, but the ones that are out here are on fire and
okay.
doing what they can to really support each other and build community together. So
great.
Good.
Ms. Wari, I want to thank you for your activism. Thank you for sharing with us. And listen, my email, my number is always available. Anytime you want to come on or distribute information to us, talk about anything you want, the door is always open.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being on. And just thank you for using this platform to amplify prisoners' voices and raise awareness about their demands.
Talk to you soon.
Take care.
We'll be right back. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back. We'll transition into open forum. And you can give us a call at 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves. As other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one black man, you are attacking all black men. And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to himself.
Now you preachers and leaders, you administrators, you teachers, you leaders, you are the worst. No cowardly, punctified leader will lead this new generation of young black men and women. Your day of leading them is finished. You can't feel it? When you talk to young people, you can't feel that you're missing them? Parents, you can't feel when you're talking to your children that this is a new generation and they don't want to hear your compromising talk? Did you hear them in Ferguson tell Jesse, get the hell out of here? You ain't no leader. I was hurting for my brother because Jesse worked hard for our people. But time has moved on. And what was good yesterday ain't no good at all today. So either you become a new vessel so that new wine can be poured into the old wine skin. for your day of leading our people is over, and it will never come back to you again. Damn it, we're still in the land of our bondage. We're still in the land of captivity. We're still a slave to the Democratic Party. Still a slave to the Republican Party. You can't even see a Freedom Party. You don't see it. You're a slave. I'm a slave. And unless we admit that we are slaves, then we can never get free. Never get free.
Put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years, and all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last, because you're a chump. A political chump.
So you could see that the government of America has been planning our demise. Any members of Congress here, any members of the civil rights movement that are here, you love this nation. You've suffered every indignity to make America better, that she might be great. And every time you forced her to make a law that was in our favor, they came right behind that law with skill and chicanery to make the law of non-effect.
When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent. innocent people. God damn America for treating her citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And I want to thank our guest that was with us this evening. Spent some time telling us about her activism in regards to the prison strike that ended on September 9th. But from what I understand, a lot of prisoners haven't stopped. And I'm Richard.
Yeah.
I'm just glad to hear. You know, they're all over this country. You know, young people, young black people, men and women that are out here getting involved. I'm just glad to hear her spirit. I'm glad to hear what she's doing. And like I told her before, the door is open whenever she wants to give us more information, to bring things to the air. I mean, that's what this program is for, information that our people don't have.
Right.
And she talked about the activism that's going on in Seattle. And listen, I take her word for it, because the people that we have spoken to from Seattle, and young black people that's been on this program, they seem to be active. They're not standing around. They seem to be active. One thing
she said, Elliot, that struck me, besides the intergenerational, I mean, that the jailhouse lawyers speaks actually, you know, looked around and seen this young woman and said, she can do this for us, you know, from, which means like having the inside be able to select, you know, or someone from the outside. But the other thing that I want to, I feel passionate about, because we always have to keep in mind the opposition. And here, you know, what she, when you asked the question of what her parents, you know, thought of her involvement, and her response of her father, which any father would have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we in community, seeing her activism, seeing her support for this kind of effort that is obviously needed to direct, as she said, the prison voice and what the reform should be compared to the city and the state and certain individuals directing, that she needs to make sure that she needs to have the assurance that we have her back.
Exactly.
That we are her protection, that we around her, because opposition is a guarantee as success in the strike, in the movement, in the petition, in the changing of legislation. As that becomes more successful, opposition becomes more intense. And people like herself will need protection. Now, however anybody use that, you know, see that term, it's important that we understand that, because a lot of times we let our people who take on these roles, technical roles or leadership roles, we so enthralled in being entertained or informed by them, we forget our duty and responsibility is also protected.
I agree, Richard. Listen, you know, I'm sorry I didn't get Brother Otis on during while she was on, but he did ask for her contact. And let me put that out over the air. Any of our listening audience that want to see her writings, see her activism, see what she's doing, and hopefully get involved to help her somehow, you can go to her website, Sawari. I'll spell it. SAWARIMI.org. That's SawariMe.org. SAWARIMI.org. That'll take you to her site. You can see what she's been doing, her activism. She has her Twitter there, her email where you can reach her, and also you can view some of her articles. And she has some of the jailhouse lawyers' writings there. She gives you a thumbnail about herself. Interesting site, Richard. That's SAWRIMI.org. Listening audience, check it out. and get involved with the sister in what she's trying to do for our brothers and sisters that are behind these walls. We'll transition into open forum. I want to read a letter, Richard, that was sent by the Freedom and Reconstruction League, Brother Rob's organization here in Philadelphia, very active organization here, that has monthly meetings at the Joseph Coleman Library in the Germantown section of Philadelphia. They sent a letter to me, and I'm going to read it on the air here. It's from Robert Gray, president of the African American Freedom and Reconstruction League. It says, "Stand with me and say no to Curtis Jones and W. Wilson Good." And he sent an open letter to all of the members of all of the black members of city council here in Philadelphia. I think it was to all of the members, but I think in particular the black members, because they all signed off on this. It says, "Greetings. To say that I am appalled is putting it mildly. To think that you and others have the temerity, the gall, the pure insensitivity to name 59th Street after the man who oversaw the murder of 11 people on May 13, 1985 is beyond my scope of understanding. Did I mention that five of those burned to death by this city under the guidance of W. Wilson Good were children? What is wrong with the people who make these decisions? You may as well go ahead and name the 6200 block of Osage after this man. That is just what my and others' posters and banners will say to this so-called street naming ceremony, which is nothing more than a whitewash of a man who said he would do it again about the horrendous hellfire that took place that day. If you're looking for someone to honor, there is Sister Ramona Africa, even now in the hospital, suffering from the residual effects of the fumes, the fire, the smoke of that day, which she barely escaped with her life. She is a hero, not that scurrilous W. Wilson Good." Now, that was an open letter by the Freedom and Reconstruction League in reference to this street naming ceremony that's slated to take place on September the 9th on North 59th Street in the city of Philadelphia. Richard, I want to read for the listening audience that might not be aware of some of the details, because I think this horrendous act, just about every black person knows it around the country. But I just want to read just a few of these things from published reports about some of the things that went on May 13th. The police obtained arrest warrants in 1985, charging four MOVE occupants with crimes including parole violations. Now, Richard, I want to read these serious crimes that are worthy of death, and I'm being facetious, and maybe I shouldn't be. And I'll start it again. The police obtained arrest warrants in 1985, charging four MOVE occupants with crimes, parole violations, contempt of court, illegal possession of a firearm, and making terroristic threats. Mayor Wilson Good and Police Commissioner Gregor Sanborn classified MOVE as a terrorist organization. Residents of the area were evacuated from the neighborhood. They were told that they would be able to return to their homes after a 24-hour period. On Monday, May 13, 1985, nearly 500 police officers, along with city manager Leo Brooks, arrived in force in an attempt to clear the building and execute the arrest warrants. Water and electricity was shut off in order to force MOVE members out of the house. Commissioner Sanborn had a long speech, and addressed MOVE members that started with, "Attention MOVE, this is America." When MOVE members did not respond, the police decided to forcefully remove the members from the house. 10,000 rounds were fired into the house that day, Richard. 10,000 rounds from high-powered rifles and other weapons. But let me read about the part that that some of the people do know about. On May 13th, 1985, at 5:20 p.m., a blue and white Pennsylvania State helicopter took off from the command post flight pad at 63rd and Walnut, flew times over 6221 Osage, and then hovered about 60 feet above the two-story house in the black middle-class section of West Philadelphia neighborhood. Lieutenant Frank Powell, chief of Philadelphia's bomb disposal unit, was holding a canvas bag containing a bomb consisting of two sticks of Tovex TR2 and C4. After radioing firefighters on the ground and lighting the bomb 45-second fuse with the official approval of W. Wilson Good and the assistance of Commissioner Gregory Sanborn. Sanborn gave, before the bomb was dropped, Sanborn gave the suspects, his suspects 15 minutes to surrender. His ultimatum was immediately rejected by the MOVE members using the organization's rooftop loudspeaker. At the end of the 15 minutes, Sanborn ordered the police to begin the assault on the fortified MOVE house, which he knew contained a number of children. Sanborn had failed to carry out W. Wilson Good's poorly communicated instructions to remove the children before assaulting the house. Gunshots rang out within minutes after high-powered water hoses were directed on MOVE's rooftop bunker. After the C4 was dropped, hold on, I'm losing my place here. Sanborn later said that the bomb was needed to remove the bunker so that police could pump tear gas into the house through the roof. This necessity of this tactical question was asked to police if they would have thrown tear gas through the front of the MOVE house, being it was already shot off by 10,000 rounds of bullets and munitions that was blown off during the morning battle. The bomb was dropped on MOVE Fortress by the state police at 5:27 without prior warning. The bomb failed to destroy the bunker but sparked a fire. Shortly after 6 p.m., the flames leap from MOVE's roof. Commissioner Sanborn decided to let the house burn, opting to use the fire as a tactical weapon to destroy the rooftop bunker. The fire was out of control within 30 minutes and soon engulfed the adjoining homes. The temperatures inside the MOVE's house reached over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. MOVE members who attempted to flee the raging inferno were driven back inside the burning house by police gunfire. One child and one MOVE adult managed to escape the inferno and was taken into police custody. Both were badly burned. The raging blaze eventually destroyed 61 homes on Osage Avenue and adjacent Pine Street, displacing over 250 people. On the morning of May 14th, the charred remains of five children and six adults were recovered from the smoldering ruins at 6221 Osage. Only three of the dead adults and none of the children were named in any arrest warrants. So, Richard, I mean, you knew what happened during that day. I just wanted to read it for some of the listening audience that might not be familiar with some of the details of the bomb that was dropped, Tovex and C4, highly flammable. The report said the temperatures inside that house reached over 2,000 degrees, so that I'm surprised that any charred remains, I'm surprised anything remained of any of the bodies, men, women, and children that were killed.
Yes,
and this stuff that's happened here in the city only goes towards what we've been talking about constantly on this program. you had elected officials that decided to do this, that didn't take it to the people and tried to do it under the cover of anonymity and to try to be slick. Nobody knew about this till it was announced. They knew about it. They didn't tell the people. They supposed to represent the people. They supposed to be mouthpieces for the people. That's what they claim.
That's one of the biggest, that's from what I gather, besides the, you know, the feeling, the empathy for those who, of the movement members that were lost. And I don't want to say particularly the children, because all human life is equally valuable. So for the adults and the children, that life was lost in the fire, but the whole thing that they would not bring this forward to at least get a sense of how the community feels.
With the community,
and not even communicate with the people in the community about it.
But this is just a micro of how black elected officials take advantage of their own constituents that look like them, look at you like you stupid. See, most of these white elected officials, they look at black folks like they're a stupid electorate anyway. And that's just a fact. But the thing is, people that look like you want to take advantage of you. Look at you like you're a stupid electorate, even though you look just like them. They have the same values as these white elected officials.
And I want to repeat the same thing that you're saying, but it rings out of my head, the insensitivity.
Certainly. You know, without question.
They would be sensitive enough to at least approach it differently, even if that's their outcome, recognizing, because this has been, you know, a longstanding position amongst a generation and now too within the black community about what happened on Osage Avenue. It's not something, no isolated incident. And when you were reading that, the thing that stuck to me was they classified them as terrorists then. We were there, right? And today, with black identity extremism as a code word, anybody can be a terrorist. Any black person can be considered a terrorist for taking a position.
Yeah, well, you know what? And I didn't read this portion, but let me read this. And for some of the listening audience that might object, just excuse the language, but I'm reading what is stated here in the published report. It says, Sandborn ordered the bomb squad members to spike. Now, it already had Tovex, two sticks of Tovex, and C4. Deadly, deadly explosive. Used in Vietnam. It says, Sandborn ordered bomb squad members to spike the bomb with shrapnel. Get them motherfuckers. That's what Sandborn said. I want to get them motherfuckers. The bomb already contained C4, a powerful, highly explosive military weapon, which was supplied to police bomb squad by the FBI in early 1985. Yeah, well, let's go to some of these calls here, because we'll probably wind up the program around 9 this evening, so I'm going to get as many of these calls in as I can. Let's go to 267. 267.
Yes, Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Good, Brother Richard. I'm listening to everything you're saying, man, and you're getting more in detail. I'm on the outside looking in, probably like you are, and the more we hear about this and the more people are involved, the more that we know. And we already know that they weren't interested in apprehending anybody out of there. They wanted to kill everybody in there. You'd already fired so many rounds. You'd already came on the rooftop with dynamite. Your thing was to kill these folks, murder them unnecessarily. The move was in that community, and they were different. And the people and them, some of them, like any other neighbors, some people like it, some people don't. It didn't call for murder, okay? Didn't call for murder of women and children, elderly, young, whoever was in there. The other thing is that, you know, the more I hear about it, because I was connected to some of those folks from that neighborhood. I'm from South Philadelphia and West Philadelphia all my life. And it's a fight. Now, this thing happened, and now we got to fight. We have to fight. In other words, we got to go all the way back to 78. Starts with 78, all the way up to 1985 to now. I mean, they drew the line now. The line is drawn. Whose side are you on? Okay, and we got to take this, man. We got to take it to the street. We got to take it to the media. We got to take it to them. These people have to open up in their minds and say to themselves, what made you do something? Like you're saying, Elliot, if you do that with the lives of people, the lives of people are always at stake with education. You're doing it with when it comes to gentrification. You're doing it when it comes to your ideology or how you think. See, it's an all around circle of how black people are treated and how black people treat each other now.
We
have to open this up. See, dialogue has to go on now. People have to resend this. That's the first thing. That's the first thing. You can't bring none of that back. You can't bring the people back. You just need to release the ones that's in prison. Or first of all, they should all be out. I think they added 10 more years to whatever they had. They should be out of prison. They shot nobody. People shot them. They should be out. We can't bring the people back from Osage Avenue. Okay? They should just release them now. Let's take it right now, open it right up, release them. Okay? And the ones that didn't survive, unfortunate, make a memorial. You're going to bring up a sign. You make a memorial of the people you killed. And let's talk about this, how you run in the government in your own city looking like your own people. Now, you just started this now. Let's open it up.
Yeah,
release them. And let's take it from there. Okay? Let's take it. And guess what? They talk about the good that Wilson good has done. The sin outweighs his good. Sin outweighs his good.
You know, when you say the line is drawn, Brother Timothy, you're talking about between these the community and these black elected officials.
And right.
Well,
the mere fact you side with, as a constituent, you side because you vote them in. You side. You got to be looking for this. Who you side? You got to take a side now.
Well, but they did it. They did it. The community didn't do it. They did it.
They did it. They did it.
Or they put it this way. They plan to do it.
I guarantee you, those constituents will go along with them. I talked to some people not too long ago. They almost like forgot about that part. Hey, you forgot about that part. Some people make excuses like, they undermine his authority.
No, I don't think no constituents going to go along with that. Some of our people don't even know what's going on.
Remind them and rehash. Don't you? I know what you mean now. And don't make it seem like he's a feeble-minded person.
Who's feeble?
See, you're feeble-minded. Good was feeble-minded.
And then
the people right now who are in council right now today ain't feeble-minded.
Good wasn't feeble-minded then. He's not feeble-minded now, even though he's 80. I mean, that don't equate to somebody being feeble-minded. He's not feeble-minded.
Listen, we up on this. We know what time it is by the clock. Are you kidding?
Well, I'm gonna grab some more of these calls because we're gonna wind up a little early this evening. But
we really gotta draw the line, man. We gotta open up dialogue, release the ones that are in prison now because they can be saved, and we take it from there. And we need a memorial, and no sign goes up. And I guess Wilson Good as a minister better be praying for himself and everything else. But the thing is, we gotta move on now and make a difference with this and what they do, how they pass legislation, how they do it sneaky, how they do it before 12 o'clock the next day, and things of that nature, on rehashing how the black community buries itself with its own hate.
Thank you for your call, brother. Let's go to Newport News. Newport News.
Good evening, my comrades. Look, I'm going to start with a question and try to keep my commentary brief because, you know, I like to try to give the stand back from the forest and don't just focus on the underbrush. Who was president in 1985?
Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. So I'm going to ask you another question because I've had this conversation about 6 years ago in a forum in Tucson, Arizona. Do you think any city in the United States would have been bombed with the cooperation of the FBI and ATF? ATF is the one that actually supplied the C4 and the accelerator that you talked about without first talking to the mayor? My point being, Good is not just talking that he would have done it again. He's keeping secrets. I worked with an organization about 6 years ago trying to see if we could get the records from the Reagan Library, but you know a lot of that stuff is under seal. Not a single city in this country would have been bombed without permission from the White House. And I tell you all the time, people think I talk conspiracy theory. I say it again. Not a single city would have been bombed with the cooperation of the ATF and the FBI had it not been okayed by the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look at the fact there is no level of government that is willing to see us do anything to liberate ourselves. I had a few more things I wanted to throw in. One of them, when you had the sister on Sawari, the only thing I was going to put in is a lot of times to try to get people connected to understanding how these prisoners affect their lives, one of the things I found out and keep trying to push is people don't realize when they put people in prison and move them around, and Max called it human trafficking, which it is, and a way to break these people, there's another factor that we don't look at. It's also part of voter suppression. You got 700,000 black people that get moved out of their area, but when you do a census count, they get counted for where they're housed. I'll give you a quick example, then I'll let you go. 60% of the prisoners in Illinois are black. Guess where the majority come from? Chicago. But guess where they get counted? Wherever they are housed. So the very white people who are putting the oppression on them get to benefit from more representation based on housing those black bodies away from their loved ones. And I love the work you guys are doing. I can't say it often enough. Power to the people if they're willing to fight for it.
Thank you for your contribution, brother. Let's try to move rapid fire here. Let's go to 21. No, wait a minute. The one call before that. Let's go to 478. 478.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk when the young lady was on, but I guess she didn't get to me, but that's okay. Because I wanted to ask her, like, what their plans are going forward and, like, if they would think about striking some of the big events, like the U.S. Open, the tennis one, not because of swing, not all that. I'm over that. But they have those big Chase symbols because Chase supports that tournament, and Chase also supports private prisons, and that's like common knowledge and things like that, or like targeting certain people that say they support, like Colin Kaepernick, not to say, well, him, because he has the Nike ad, but again, he was also at the U.S. Open tournament because they showed him at a place where a company that supports prisons are promoted and kind of things like that. What they think about, like, targeting, let's say, like, the Braves in Atlanta, like, the best member. Oh, Bill Cobbs, I don't know his name. Bill Player, whatever, supports prison slavery because he's a Brave. You know, kind of things like that. But sometimes things like that bring more attention to an issue. That's what I was going to ask her.
But, well, do me a favor. You got a pen?
No, but I'm by my computer, though.
Okay. Did you get that website down?
Oh, I did look at it. Yeah,
okay,
I have
good.
It. I looked at it already. Well, she has some.
Yeah,
I saw the articles. So
yeah, if you ask her, she's very receptive. So she'll get back to you.
Okay. Because like I said, I was watching it. I'm like, all these chase symbols and all these things, maybe that's a sad strategy. That way more people will become aware. And, you know, when you mess up people's sports, they get mad. And then it'll be on ESPN. They love to talk about race, blah, blah, blah. You never know where that can go because they love to talk about race and racism. They act like they don't, but they do.
And if you're in, to be also be supportive, or at least have this in mind, since the governor's race is going on in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
The woman that's running for governor, this is a question whether she's aware of the strike. How is her position in relationship to that? I'm pushing this Prison Litigation Reform Act. So if she comes around your area, those are kind of questions that will help propagate this movement.
Well, if either one of them comes, I ask either one, the man or the woman, because that's one thing. We can't just stick because she's the black lady, ask the black lady.
Right.
Whoever comes, you know, I can ask whoever comes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm fair with that. But just that we have a responsibility to be able to assist in moving the campaign forward.
Thank you for your call, sister.
Okay, thank you.
Peace. Let's go to 404. Okay, maybe 404 is not there. We'll put them back on hold. Let's go to 215. 215?
Hey, Brother Elliot. Hey, Brother Richard. How you doing, man?
How are you, sir?
All right. Yeah, I listened to the sister when they was talking about the prisons. Very, very informative. Very informative. I just want to go back on what Brother Tim was saying about Curtis Jones. And thanks for reading that letter by Brother Rob, Brother Elliot. See, to me, I'm not surprised because, you know, I'm a Muslim and so is Curtis Jones. But I'm going to tell you something. I'm not one to say negative things, but something always about that brother rubbed me the wrong way. I always came across, I even had this discussion with Brother Rob about Curtis. I always thought he was an arrogant Negro anyway. I always thought he was an arrogant Negro and stuff. Just something about the guy just rubs me the wrong way. That's why I'm not really surprised he would do that because he just strikes me with that arrogant type anyway. But see, like Tim said, it's him trying to advocate for Wilson Good, who presided over the wanton murder of our people. He should be advocating to get those sisters and brothers that's still in prison. You need to be, that's what that Negro should be doing, you know? But it just go to show you the lack of respect they got for black people, you know what I'm saying? It's that simple. You can't get around it and stuff, man. You know, the lack of respect. That's why, like I say, you got a group of Negroes in this office today. And like I say, all they do is do all they can to work against the interests of black people. Like I told you before about the stadium thing with Temple, that is a bogus. That thing is nothing but a ruse. Because like I say, Dow Clark, just like Curtis Jones, they don't give a damn. All they care about is getting their paycheck and sweethearting with white folks. That's all them Negroes care about. They put their bogus black face on when it's necessary. But at the end of the day, they suck up the white people. And like I say, that stadium is going to be built and stuff because the fix is already in. And like I said, Dow Clark will come with his little weak punk response. I tried to do the best they could. Y'all know I was with y'all and everything, but the zoning got in the way. I couldn't overrule the zoning and all that. He'll come with some old bogus stuff, and I guarantee you Temple going to start building that stadium by either the end of this year or next year. You can mark my words. You heard it from me first, so it is what it is. These niggas, nothing. I mean, he could stop. Dow Clark really wanted to stop it? Sure he could, because the city council president, he got that power. But he's not, because like I say, Temple done greased that Negro pockets enough, and he going to get his little check and his little fried chicken and biscuits, and he'll be like a little happy Negro that he is. So, I mean, it is what it is. And like I said, Curtis Jones cut from that same cloth. All them, like I said, them niggas ain't for black people. They for their own self, lying in their pockets, getting their big pensions after they leave public office, and sweetening up the white folks, whether it be whites, whether it be Jews, Catholics, Irish, whether they white folks, they going to suck up to them, because that's all he's looking out for, the white man's interest, as simple as that. And I'm gone because I know y'all pressed for time, so thank you for letting me say what I wanted to say.
Brother, thank you for your call, man.
Thanks, Brother Elliot. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to 646. 646?
Yes, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard.
How are you, sir?
I think I'm going to have to change my name from Jay to the closer. Mm-hmm. It's my job to close this show out. Hey, listen, hey, Elliot, could you give me the spelling that sister's website, please?
Okay, let me do it. Hold on one second. That's SAWARIMI.org.
Oh, beautiful. She was very good. She seems like she's no older than maybe, what, 22, 23?
Well, yeah. She's young. She's young.
Yeah, she's young.
I mean, they got her right out of college.
Huh?
They got her right out of college.
Yeah, well, you know, it's good. It's good when you get a sister like that right out of college because you know she's going to be committed to the cause, man. And listen, you have to take your hat off to the sister.
Exactly.
And be grateful that, you know, she's going to do the best that she can to help our people. And, you know, the story is never really told about the whole prison industrial system anyway. It's one of the other things that we haven't been able to change the narrative on. You know, at some point in time, we as a people are going to have to figure out how to change all of the narratives in regards to things that are so harmful to us. Because if we don't, we're going to be in the same situation. Yeah. I mean, I can never understand how any black person could not want to put their foot up Wilson's good behind. You know, I can never understand how you could ever support him again. I can never understand how he shouldn't have been or should have been ostracized out of the black community for what he did. But, you know, that boils down to is we don't control the narrative. And then, you know, most of those Negroes on WHUD, they supported what he did. You know what I mean? Because what happened? The narrative was placed by our enemy. So until we get to that point to be able to really deal and address it, we're going to have this happen again and again and again. Unfortunately and tragically, because the sad thing is, man, you know, like you said, I think his sister Ramona right now is suffering. Thank God that the people were able to raise enough money to, you know, help her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Thank God for that. That right there really impressed me. You know, I even gave a small donation myself. And I'm not going to lie to you. I don't like giving no Negro no donation. You know what I mean? Because sometimes your money really goes to waste with some of these individuals. But listen, this is what I wanted to say to you right quick. You know, they had the Harlem Day parade today, man. And let me tell you, man, the participation was sad. It was absolutely sad. Matter of fact, they've even shortened the route on the parade. We in serious trouble, man. We in serious trouble, man. And you can't totally blame it on gentrification, I don't think. Because like I said Friday night, there ain't that many crackers in Harlem. There's a great deal of crackers in Harlem, but there ain't that many crackers on 7th Avenue. You know, Adam Clayton Powell, which is 7th Avenue, was the street where the parade was on. But they used to have it from 110th Street up to, like, I think it was 147th Street. Man, now the parade is from 110th Street to 135th Street. Tragic.
Well, do me a favor, Jay, if you get an opportunity, look up and see how much money that parade gets as opposed to other what they consider ethnic parades. I'm just curious.
Oh, they don't get the amount of money that other ethnic parades get. I don't even have to look that up. I know that for a fact because I know the leadership that's involved with the black parade is not on the same level that the rest do. You know, they ain't out there, you know, trying to get that money on the level that the Hispanics and the rest are because, you know, the Hispanics honestly have certain key positions in the city council where they have those budgets in play. Blacks don't really have that type of, you know, position. I mean, you know, they have a couple of blacks that are in somewhat key positions, but the majority of them, they really don't have no power in the city. They got a special type Negro out there in Brooklyn, which is the largest borough in the city. He's talking about trying to run for mayor. And this cocksucker, he's already pandering to the Asians and to the Jews. So I guess he must think that the Negro is going to back him regardless. But, you know, he's another sellout. They all sellouts, man. You know what I mean? They all try to get to the position. And as soon as they get in the position, all they do is curry to the white boy and the Jew. That's all. And now you got a situation to where you got to start pandering to the slant eye. You know what I mean? Anytime I got to be as a man in a place like New York City, got to pander to the slant eye and the Baba Louie, I know I'm in trouble. I might as well just give it the hell up and stop fighting. Because I basically, once you get to that point, you've totally been marginalized. It's just the fact of the matter. I'm sorry to say it, but it's the truth. It's just like if you look at this country, we have gone from, you know, having some sort of a say to now being in back of homosexuals. Anytime you as a people are in back of homosexuals, you just basically are lost. Now, I don't give a damn what nobody say. I'm telling you, and I'm saying it right on these airs, the homosexuals got more power in this country than black folks do. And we built this damn thing. So that just tells you where we are. And if anybody could get on this airway and tell me that the homosexuals ain't got more power than black people, I want you to get on and tell me. And I beg for one of you to get up here and tell me I'm wrong. But that's the reality of where we know. Okay, and why did it get to that position? Because we helped it. The black church and Negroes like Obama put us in that position. But those are our so-called leadership and friends. And here it is. All they've done is just marginalize us to the point to where as you got other ethnic groups that are about to dominate us. You ever think when a Baba Louie or a Slant Eye or one of these other nationalities get into power that they're not going to put their foot in African people's bond? You think that? You think that? Tell me if I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, I want you to tell me. You know, I want you to tell me, Ricky, am I wrong?
Maybe.
You tell me, huh?
We're already, as you say, and you know, you don't have to because we're, for whatever reason, we're already in a powerless position. So it don't take no effort to, like, you know, and what you're characterizing, to put a foot, because to even be, as you say, here we are, we got the biggest number, the voting number, you know, we've been here the longest. So if they're getting those positions, as you call them, the positions of authority and positions of power, then it's something that we haven't done to allow other smaller minorities to be able to dominate when we are the larger minority.
Well, you know, the biggest thing that we haven't done is we haven't took care of ourselves.
Right.
We haven't took care of ourselves. You know, you can't take care of your enemy before you take care of yourself. I don't want to do nothing for my enemy. I don't want to do nothing for white folks. If I'm ever in the position of power, what am I going to do something for white folks? Do you ever see white folks do something for us? Unless it's not beneficial to them. There's never going to be nothing that's going to be beneficial for black folks when you have a collusion with white folks, because at some point in time, the white folks are going to cooperate and take it over. It's just the fact of history. Every time we have been in an association with white folks, what have they done? Took it over, manipulated, and benefited from it. AKA put in contention the NAACP. Got a whole bunch of Negro faces there, but all they do is beck and call for white folks to keep other Negroes in line. They don't never challenge the Jew, and they don't never challenge white folks. If anything, they're trying to integrate the black behind into doing more for the bastards. And giving them more of yourself too. You never see them promote black-owned businesses separated from the white man. Every time they talk about black-owned businesses, they talking about working in accordance with white folks to get subcontracts and all of that other nonsense. And who's the overseer of that? The daddy. But listen, I'm going to close the show. And I'm going to say, as always, thank you very much, Brother Richard. Thank you, Brother, very much, Brother Elliot. And hey, Richard, it's time for you to close up shop early tonight. Go home, have you a cup of tea, and get ready for the daddy tomorrow. The daddy wants you bright-eyed and bushy-tailed so you can do his work. And Brother Elliot, you know, I don't know, it's like old barbers that I know, they take Monday off for a day of relaxation.
That's right.
I hope you have that occasion to have a day off for relaxation. Yeah.
Thank you,
sir.
You
know what I mean, brother Elliot, because you got the way. You're not trying to go see the daddy for no reason other than him giving you some money. But you, Brother Richard, you my man. You my idol. You my hero, because you are a devoted worker to the daddy. Have a good weekend, brother.
Peace.
God bless you both. All right,
now. All right, take care.
You know, Richard, let me say something before we close. You know, Europeans have observed us ever since we've been here. They've been studying us, studying our habits, and trying to write a blueprint on how to deal with us. Sometimes we upset that blueprint, but they always try to stay one step ahead. Now, during the times that our people were in chattel bondage, they couldn't really choose the leadership that evolved out of that. The Garnett, the Henry Holland Garnetts, the Martin Delaney's, the Douglases, a lot of the women that were involved, they couldn't really choose that leadership, and they didn't really want to recognize that as leadership, even though our people did. And even during the period of Reconstruction, when Black folks started using that vote to send leaders to these executive branches of office, they couldn't really choose them. And a lot of those men during that period, they really wanted to represent Black interests and Black people. But after that, after they said that, after Reconstruction was basically torn apart, they got together and said, we're not going to have this. We can't. And you can listen, you can see it. You'll never see it in history where they got together and made other plans. But all you got to do is read between the lines. Know the historical background of Europeans. They said, we can't have this. We got to choose those people's leadership. So when you had other organizations coming along, like the colored, what was that organization?
The colored convention.
I think you had another one before that Niagara movement came along. Mm-hmm. And definitely before the NAACP came along.
Right.
See, during that period, early 1900s, that's when they started formulating groups with what they considered privileged Blacks that they could seem as though they could control. Let's control their leadership, control who's in charge, almost setting it up like it was on a plantation. The same type of hierarchy. And it still exists today. It still exists. And the mindset among a lot of that leadership is the same mindset that existed when our people were in chattel enslavement. I think Jay mentioned when he used the movie character of Steven in that movie Django. That same mindset. They can talk like they're in your favor and do little things like they're in the favor of their community, but they work in the interest of Europeans. They work in the interest of white folks. We can do something about that. We can. We have to. We have to. It's not a, we don't have any other choice.
You're right.
Again, I want to thank our guest that was with us, Ms. Amani Sawari. Check out her website to our sister that's in the Atlanta area. She can get involved and help her out, be part of her activism. She'll readily respond to you. She's not the type that kind of leaves your email out there. She'll respond. And you can see that she loves to work. So get in touch with her. Check out her website and see all the activism she's involved in. It's more people out there like her Believe me, it is. So the situation ain't as bleak as sometimes we might believe, and especially this television and this media want us to believe our situation is bleak. It's kind of funny, Richard, this situation that happened in North Carolina and a lot of areas that it hit is heavily populated by our people. Mm-hmm. Wilmington, New Bern, our people are all down in those areas. And the first thing they did, and I know you saw it on the television, or with some looting, they run over there and they show some black folks running out of one of them dollar stores, Dollar General or something.
Right.
With bags and stuff in their hand. Oh, you know you're looting? The same thing. Those are the images that they want to put forth. But, you know, we know what we got to do. The situation, it's a struggle, but we can win, and we're going to win.
Right.
I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and listen, the lineup is what it is, and it's what it's going to be for the next month. We're going to have some new programs starting in the month of October, but the lineup is Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Provocative program. Has built a huge audience, and that people love it. 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock later on Monday evening, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. After that, Let's Buy Black 365 Connect with Sister Nataki and Brother Talib. They'll be starting their second season very shortly. I talked with Sister Nataki not too long ago, about a week ago, and they're in. They're kind of winding up the filming of their second season, so that'll be coming up on Time for Awakening very soon on Tuesday. Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive is back with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. And Friday night's Time for Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware of, I know, the thing that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, save the children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. Can't we do?
something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.